This podcast is supported by the growing community of artists and art lovers through the Gently Does It Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/John Dalton Gently Does It to join the conversation. I'm very happy to be talking to Dave Lebo today in California. Dave is an artist. He paints retro pulp subject matter in a classical style. Aliens, robots, vampires, winged eyeballs, and pinup girls. He's had a long association with the entertainment industry, and his work is collected by many celebrities. And he's had numerous solo and group shows in his 40-plus year painting career. So hello, Dave. It's very nice to be talking to you.
Hi, John. It's really an honor to be talking with you.
Oh, you're welcome. It's great to have you on. I saw on your Facebook feed that you posted this picture of yourself in front of a big Ramones poster. Are you a big Ramones fan?
I do like the Ramones. My wife and I and my daughter were at the Grammy Museum, and there's a Ramone show going on. I don't know if it's still going on, but it wasn't that long ago. I think that was right before the Christmas holiday or close to it, and that's when that picture was shot. My wife shot that of me in front of the Ramones poster there at the exhibit.
Did you ever see the Ramones live?
You know, I did once when I was in college in Boston. It had to have been in 1977, 1978. Are you a Ramones fan, by the way?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's hard to be a Ramones fan. I find like it's harsh music. It's harsh music to listen to a lot of, but you know, at the right time in the right place, it's pretty fantastic.
You know, when I was younger and I did see them, they were so loud, and maybe the sound check hadn't been done correctly, and they didn't sound good. It was just a barrage of sound. But now, when I listen to them, they sound very poppy and very rock and roll. I mean, I love their classic. They kind of have a classic rock kind of feel. I know there's a punk feel, but there's certainly not like the hardcore punk thing that one, two, three, four, and it's just like a barrage of craziness, you know. But I do like rock and roll. I'm glad you brought the Ramones up, because I listen to a lot of that when I paint, and I know probably some people listen to classical music or something, but I tend to like – well, I like things with a melody. So, but it's got to have a bit of a rock and roll feel too.
All right, yeah. No, I can. I saw, amazingly, I saw the Ramones live twice in Dublin. Not at the same time.
Really?
You know, years apart, yeah. And both times they were just like exactly the way you described, just a wall of sound. It was right down the back of the hall, which, you know, I would have been, I don't know, 18, 19, something like that. Which you didn't do, like, you know, back then you kind of tried to get up the front, but it was so loud and so undecipherable, you know. It was more just the energy, I suppose, of seeing them. But
I think they may have been better in a small venue like CBGB's, which I never got to see them in a place like that, but in a small hall possibly, I think, but who knows?
Who knows?
Since I never did see them in a small place.
Before we get into your paintings, I wanted to ask you about your animation work. Because, like, in amongst your classical art training, you did an MFA in experimental animation with Cal Arts. And I'm just curious about what your attraction was to animation.
Boy, you really do some homework, don't you? You really research the artists. And I've been a fan of your podcast for a while, so I've listened to a few of them. And you really do go into people's work and life. That's really neat that you research it like that. Well, to answer that question, you know, I've been interested in animation for years and years and years. I've always just loved it because it encompasses drawing and technology, obviously, because it's more of a modern art form. You have to have a film camera, 24 frames a second, you know, the technical thing of shooting it. It's like a modern zoetrope. But did you ask where does my interest in animation come from? As I'm going,
yeah, because it seemed like a funny kind of swerve. You know, you're sort of gone along this very classical path, and then you swerve off into animation, and then come back into the classical painting. I was just kind of curious about it, like what drew you in that direction.
Okay, well, I always had an interest, but then somewhere it had to have been in the late '80s, early '90s. I was painting traditionally, and I was living in New Mexico, but I had some sort of creative crisis, started having a lot of insomnia, and I just wasn't happy with my life, and I moved away from there, and I went out to California. My brother lived out here. Now I'm here. I'm still in California. And I just made this big move away from Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I had been living and painting very traditional flower paintings, portraits, still life, nothing like what I do now at all. I think that I'm going off into a whole other area of talking about that. But so I thought maybe I would get into the entertainment industry, like maybe I could work for one of these houses that when I say houses, like outfits, like Jim Cameron's Digital Domain, something like that. That was my idea, maybe. That didn't really happen. I kind of – so basically what happened was I had always had an interest in animation. I always went to the animation festivals that would play at the movie house probably in every city. I can't remember what they're called. There was one called Spike and Mike's Animation Festival, I think. And you'd see these great animations. That always was in the back of my mind. I always thought, God, I'd love to do that. That's so cool. And when I was a kid, now I remember, I had an interest and did some animations with a Super 8 camera. I'd actually forgotten that. Since you asked me, I guess it's just kind of bringing it up from the bottom of my brain somewhere that I had done that when I was a kid. You know, my brother and I had made little stop motions and stuff with a Super 8.
Yeah.
Anyway, when I had that creative crisis and I moved away, I was out here in California, and I started going to sketch groups at the California Institute for the Arts. I wasn't going to the school yet then, and there was an artist named Corny Cole who had been in the animation industry, and I attended a lot of those life drawing groups. And there were all these people trying to get in the animation industry, and eventually it just led me to actually go back to school as an older guy. I was in my late 30s, early 40s – no, I had to have been in my early 40s. And I thought I just ended up going to school there, and that's how I got into the animation, actually much more than I had ever thought I would, because I actually started going for a master's degree in experimental animation. So I actually got away from my painting for a long time, probably about 10 years or so, I guess, maybe longer, that I didn't really paint traditionally, but I was painting and drawing in a different way. I was doing a lot of life drawing and then drawing all that animated cells, or really just animation on paper. I was doing it a traditional way.
So I saw you. Did you make that movie Night Sweats? Is that all yours?
I did. It's all mine. But I don't know if you saw a good high fidelity version, not a compressed pixelated version.
Yeah, I watched the version from your YouTube channel. So I don't know what that one is, but it seemed
hopefully
pretty good.
Yeah, hopefully it looked good.
Yeah, it looked like a lot of work. Like,
well, that was
like
all drawn on.
Yeah.
It was a lot of work, yeah. It was yeah, drawn all on paper and pencil, inked with little washes of watercolor.
You know, I used to work in animation myself.
No, what did you do in the animation industry?
I pretty much did everything except draw and paint. So I started off in camera. That was my main kind of thing.
And what company did you work for?
It was with a company called Emerald City Productions. That's where I started. And then I worked in a few different ones in Ireland. Murakami Wolf, you might have known them. We did Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the TV series.
Wow.
Yeah, if you look me up on IMDb or whatever, you can see.
That's really cool.
Camera work, yeah.
Oh, I'm going to do that. That's cool. So you ran – were those big multiplane cameras there at those companies?
No.
It more just on a platen of sort with cell? Or?
Yeah, it was just cell, just flat. Yeah, we did. And I did have a it was around the time when the motion control was coming into the rostrum cameras. So, you know, one of my first experience of computers was running a big rostrum camera, you know. So we did in that place, we did quite a few interesting stuff, but no multiplane, but like rotoscoping and back projection and, you know, optical and zooming and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it was all just before the computers really, you know, the computer generated animation really came in, where it was all still being done on the camera, you know.
Right. And those are huge cameras too. They take up an entire room.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Now they have a couple of those still, even at CalArts in these rooms, and now I'm forgetting the technical name of those big cameras, but
rostrum
I've worked
cameras,
on those when I was – the rostrum, yeah, I've worked on those there as well. but probably not to the professional extent, obviously, that you have.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Didn't know that you were in animation. That's interesting.
Yeah, years ago. So did you make any other films other than Night Sweats? Because I couldn't find anything else, but I know you worked in animation.
I didn't put any of my other student films up there. I made a bunch of cutout films, and I had a great time doing those. And then I did get into the industry in a sense. I never worked for any big companies like DreamWorks or Disney or anything like that, though I think I did try to get into the Disney background painting. It got rejected every time I tried. I took several tests. They have these tests. Yeah. But I worked for a company called Greystone Television out here in Los Angeles. They're in Burbank. And they produced – I don't know if they still exist. They produced a show called The Secret Life Of, and it ran for about 5 years. It was on the Food Network. And I did 12 seconds of animation every week, really cheesy animation in the Flash program. So I would do – like the writers would send me a little synopsis of what they wanted for this 12 seconds, which sounds like very little if you don't know – obviously, you don't know much about animation, but since you do, you know that that can be a lot of work, even if you're working in Flash.
That's a huge amount for a week.
It is. But it was lots of fun. I loved it. And I was doing the storyboard, and then I would send it. And everything was done by email, which was kind of fun. So they'd send me something by email, what they wanted. I would do the storyboards. I'd draw them out. And then they would approve them or tell me what I needed to change. Then I'd do all this research because it would be like – the history of chocolate or the history of cheese or the history of French fries. There's all these like odd historical things about that stuff that, you know, the history of French fries or some guy in Prussia or something, as I remember that. I can't remember the exact story that invented the French fry. And so I'd have to draw these things out and I do them in Flash. And I don't know if you know much about the Flash technology program. I haven't used it in a long time now. It was made by Macromedia. And then I think Adobe. Now, I've just gone back completely into my traditional painting, and so all that stuff is kind of like if you don't use it, you lose it, and I don't even think I could do a Flash animation anymore for the life of me. But I used a Wacom tablet, and I draw it all out versus my thesis film, which was all drawn traditionally and didn't use any of those digital tools except maybe After Effects at the end when I scanned everything into the computer.
Yeah, it's funny, though. When I was watching it, I kind of thought – because there's – you know, I'll put a link to it on the thing, but just if you're someone's listening to this and they haven't seen it, it's funny you were talking about having insomnia leading to your your artistic crisis, because it's
been
kind of about someone who has insomnia.
Exactly.
Yeah. But anyway, there's a coffee pot that turns into a kind of a tripod, a sort of Orson Welles kind of War of the Worlds looking tripod. And as soon as it did that, I thought, oh, that's very, you know, that immediately stamps it as very clearly yours.
You know, it's funny. I never thought of that, but I did, you know, possibly if I hadn't gone finally into animation, which was something I think I always wanted to do, even in a totally not like big company way, maybe I wouldn't be painting as personally as I finally feel like I am. I think I finally became who I was supposed to be or became myself, because in the early part of my life when I was in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and before that in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I grew up, I think I was just painting to really satisfy my mom and dad, who were always, you know, very supportive, but I was painting these very – I'm not putting traditional things down – I mean, just like a Chardin-like still life. And I love Chardin. I love traditional painting. I still love things that are just full of beauty. But I think maybe there was always something that I wasn't expressing about myself that was personal and that was using more of my imagination. I mean, I used to look at stuff, commercials, TV commercials, stories, films. I go, oh, my God, that's so cool. I'd like to do that. How come I'm not doing that? Maybe I'm doing more of what I feel like I should be. And I feel like I'm not even doing enough. Like there's so much more to explore and so much room to grow and improve and get better at. But I do finally feel like maybe I'm on the road, and I'm a bit of a late bloomer because I'm an older guy now, and hopefully I can stay healthy and live another 30 years or so, because I got to get this career going, you know?
I get the hang of this art thing.
I mean, you put a quote up on your podcast website, or maybe it was on Instagram, about, I think it was Pablo Casals, that said he was 90 years old and he still practiced because he felt like he was just – he was improving a little bit, or he still could improve. That really was meaningful to me when I saw that.
Yeah, it's a great little quote, isn't it?
Yeah. Because, I mean, no matter how old you get or how young you are, I mean, we still need to practice and get better. We still need to keep striving. And if you, and I think maybe that was part of my crisis back in Santa Fe. I didn't know where I was going anymore with my painting, and somehow I stopped or something and went somewhere else. And then I had to come back.
Yeah. Even though you were saying that you never worked for a big company, that probably worked in your favor, because, like, I know from my own experience that you like it, there's a lot of animation goes on that nobody ever really hears about, particularly if it's for TV, because it gets gobbled up by the, you know, insatiable appetite for content that TV has. Yet you end up in strange places, like you're saying, I have to, you know, do a 12-second animation on the history of cheese or cheeseburgers or cheese, whatever, you know. And you have to push your brain into unusual places, you know. Like, I'd say most, apart from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I worked in animation like for 10 years in total, I'd say, about. And that's the only thing that people know. You know, like I worked on the animated Charles Dickens stories, you know, nobody knows those.
Wow.
I worked on so many shows that never happened, you know, and yet, like, there was a huge amount of creative effort went into coming up with, you know, series. Like, I wrote scripts for, like, loads of series that, again, never happened, and just through funding issues and, you know, political like or economic issues. But yet, you know, it really does push you, because it's unlimited animation, and particularly animation, you know, 20 years ago, when it wasn't as easy to do stuff on computers, you could, you know, people went to it because you could do stuff in it that you couldn't do in live action, you know. So
in
Ireland, there was a big company. It's kind of like the Disney of Ireland would have been Sullivan Bluth. They made An American Tale and really big, you know, very Disney-esque kind of movies that went into the cinema.
Bluth. Bluth?
Yeah, Don Bluth.
That's a
Don
big name.
Bluth.
That's him.
Yeah,
Oh, that's a very big name. And I didn't really realize he had worked in Ireland as well. Sullivan Bluth.
Yeah, he set up a huge studio. You know, 300-400 people were employed there. And it was like little Disney, you know. And that was great.
Yeah.
And, you know, and a lot of the people in the smaller studios around had that kind of thing that you were sort of saying, oh, I never worked in Sullivan Bluth. But like, the people who worked in Sullivan Bluth, while they got to do great things, it was all funneled in behind one singular vision, which was Don Bluth's, which is the way animation works, film works.
Yeah, that's a big vision, too. Right.
Yeah, but they never got to go into all the quirky, strange places that, you know, the smaller companies had to go into, trying to get ads or little small things for TV or whatever, you know.
Isn't that the way it always seems to be with this entertainment stuff? So much stuff doesn't get green lit because maybe there's just too many cooks in the kitchen or something sometimes. And that's what's great about doing artwork, I guess, for yourself. As you know, you're an artist and a writer. You know, you're just producing it, just one guy pretty much. You might have to have a model here and there. But you get to make the whole thing. And it's pretty inexpensive to create, in a way, compared to a movie or an animation.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Oh, animation is, like, hugely labor-intensive, as you know. It just takes forever.
Yeah.
Right. Let's dive into the painting, then. This is a question from Instagram, and it's from artist Rachel Jones. And she says, such strong narratives seem to be present. Is it completely intentional, or a giving way to a stream of consciousness? Of course, either way, the craft comes in to balance it all and make a working art piece in the end. But curious about the jumping off point.
Yeah, that's a good question. Wasn't that in reference? I'm on Instagram as well, and I think I saw that. And you had illustrated or reproduced, rather, that painting I had done of two children riding a large raven, a big blackbird, and you're looking at a city below. Do you think she was referring to that painting, or is she just talking about everything that she might have seen, maybe?
Or does it even matter? My sense of it was, you see your body of work generally. I didn't think it was particularly for that picture.
Okay. You know, some of them, well, when I think of that picture, that was a commission for a woman who had two children. And so that was a specific narrative. But some of them are kind of stream of consciousness, I guess, when I come up with the idea. And then sometimes the idea behind the painting may be completely oblique, meaning for me, it doesn't have a direct, a complete story, and I want the viewer to project their own, whatever they're getting from it, into it. It's kind of fun to have that happen. And then I think for me, I might have my own idea. It's so personal that it's like there's one of women kind of rising up towards some flying saucers. Mm-hmm. I had had some – I guess I could go into that one. And I mean, I have a friend – he moved away, my friend Walt Morton and I, and we would work together sometimes and shoot pictures of models. He's a really interesting painter and writer, if you ever are interested in talking to him one day, Walt Morton.
I know.
Anyway, we were working together. We had a model named Kelly C. Great model. And I have a young daughter, and we had a trampoline. And so we had I had an idea to be doing people flying or something. So we were photographing this model out there jumping on the trampoline nude. And I had all this reference of this girl like jumping up. And later I was looking at them. I went, she could be, you know, this just looked like she's being sucked up into a flying saucer or an eyeball or – I don't know. That's just how I came up with some of them. Sometimes I'll have an idea before I even shoot the models, but that one was from that photo shoot.
So when you were saying that sometimes you get the idea for a picture from, you know, as a result of the photo shoot that you've done or whatever, and other times you know what you want going in. Where did those ideas, like how do you collect those ideas and how do they come about to you?
Well, a lot of times before a show, I'll start writing ideas down. I mean, I'll have a theme, and like the theme was just given to me for one of my earliest shows when I started doing this more imaginative work, which was like end days and things like that. And so I would just start jotting ideas down around that theme. So it wasn't anything like I'd be dreaming or something. But then maybe I'd be walking and I would sometimes use a voice memo, or if I had a piece of paper, I'd write it down, anything to record it. So I'd start collating or collecting these notes in a spiral notebook or something on ideas that I could do surrounding that theme. And I think that's how I usually work in the beginning, is just jotting down ideas. And since some of them just come out of the air, I think walking, I'll be walking the dog with my wife and daughter, and all of a sudden I'll go, oh, wow, I could do this. And sometimes I'll mention it. Sometimes I won't, because I don't want to jinx it. And then other times maybe I'll be looking through magazines or something. Or I had some ideas one time come to me because I was looking at some Charles Adams cartoons, and they were really strange. And they had sort of an uncanny feeling. And I think for the show that I had just done in May, I had wanted to try to do things that were more uncanny or just weird, odd kind of things that seem strange in everyday life more. At least that's what I was thinking I wanted to do. And I saw a couple of these Charles Adams cartoons, and one, maybe I'm giving too much away about myself with this, because I didn't plagiarize them, but I did use the idea that I saw. There was a picture of a woman. I think she was walking into the door of her through the door of a room, and the camera or the point of view is up in the air, and you're looking down, and she's kind of walking in, and her husband is floating up in the air, and I don't remember what the caption was. She was just saying something to him, and I was like, that's really funny. But you know, I've seen that same thing in a Mary Poppins the live action Mary Poppins. Isn't there somebody floating up in the air? I don't even know for what reason they are. And then there's a Harry Potter where somebody, some hex goes onto them and they float up in the air or something. Anyway, I think that's how I came up with that idea for a man floating up in the air, and then a little girl goes, what the hell is that person doing up in the air? Yeah. So that's how that, you know, so sometimes it'll be a comic, or it can be anything. you know, just right. stuff comes in, I think, and stimulates me. And then sometimes even talking with a person, just bullshitting about it, or going on a little conversation about an idea, that helps me a lot, because then I start riffing on it. So it's a bit collaborative if somebody would help me along. And I don't get that a lot because I'm just alone with my thoughts many a times. but if I start riffing with somebody, like have a like if we were hanging out and I could say, hey, John, I have this weird idea of a tentacle coming out of a sewer and it's grabbing a kid by the leg. And then you would come back with something. Somehow that kind of brainstorming, that's what I was going after, that brainstorming helps me a little bit. If somebody would help me with that.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd have to pick the right person though, really.
You
said that to the wrong person, they'd be like, what?
Yeah, they might look at you kind of strange. It's true. But brainstorming really helps. I wish I had a brainstorming partner. That would really be helpful.
Well, after this podcast, you're going to be inundated with requests, I can assure you. Okay, so you use Norman Rockwell's method for creating a storytelling picture. Can you explain what that is and how you use it?
I'm a huge Norman Rockwell fan. And when I was a kid, my dad actually instilled in me that, or probably introduced me to him. I think I had very supportive parents. So when I was in high school, my dad gave me this book called How I Paint a Picture by Norman Rockwell. I still have it. It's a bit threadbare. I actually saw on Amazon that it's worth a lot of money now. I don't know if they've even published it again. You could probably still get copies of it there for anybody that's listening and would like to get it. It's a great book. He goes over exactly how he paints a picture from the idea sketches. And other artists do this. There's a painter that I really admire named Greg Manchess. I don't know if you're familiar with him, if you've seen his work.
Yeah, a little bit.
I took a workshop with him several years ago where it was just about drawing these little idea sketches. And that was very helpful. And this was what Norman Rockwell does or did because he's not alive anymore. He would sit down and get an idea, and I like narrative painting, and he was, of course, working for illustrations, but you can use this if you're doing an imaginative piece. Doesn't matter if it's for an illustration or not. It could be for a personal piece, and you just start trying to come up with your ideas. He said he would think of a drunken sailor leaning against a lamppost because he had to start somewhere, and he said nothing would happen unless he would start drawing. So he would have a pencil there, so he didn't just think. I mean, you might first have something written down on your telephone or on a piece of paper, but then you start drawing. So you get that pencil and you start kind of doodling, and it doesn't have to be very good because you're drawing out of your head, unless you're as great as Frank Frazetta, where you could draw really good out of your head, really well out of your head, rather. So my little cartoony thumbnail sketches aren't too good. But anyway, that's how Norman Rockwell would start. He would start with this stream of consciousness, actually, it seemed like, because he'd think of a drunken sailor leaning against a lamppost. And from there, he would say, what does the drunken sailor see? I don't know. He would just go on and on. And now, I don't know if he always started with the drunken sailor, but that's the example he used in his book. From there, he'd have all these thumbnail sketches. When he gets one, he said where bells would go off, he knew that was a good idea. He might show it to other people, too, and see what they would think. And Manchester would just keep going and going until you got this really great composition. And that's probably what Rockwell would do too. So once you get this really good composition on your thumbnail sketches, then you go about finding your models and props that you would put in the place of your thumbnails. So it all comes from out of your head first.
I just want to go back a little bit, though, because when you're talking about doing the thumbnails and adding things in, are you also removing things from the composition as well? Like, are you trying different things out?
Yeah, exactly. You might try to see a different camera angle or point of view. Today we have a camera, so we always think of camera angles in terms of cinema. I don't see how that can't get in there now in our modern age where we have cinema, which has opened things up so much. You know, you could, what if our view is from a worm? You know, we're lying on the floor, we're looking up. What if we're up in the ceiling looking down? And you start moving around in 3D. And that's what I learned from Greg Manchess, was let's look around. Like, so you've got these people on a stage, and it wouldn't hurt too much to maybe even make a little maquette. And I should mention James Gurney at this point too, because that really – I don't know. You must be familiar with James Gurney's work, right?
Again, just a little bit, not a huge amount.
He wrote a book called Imaginative Realism: How to Paint What Doesn't Exist, and that is an incredible book. And I don't even think I'd be able to do some of these imaginative paintings I've been trying to make without his book, because it was really a revelation. Nobody in art school ever taught me that. I think I had heard that Thomas Hart Benton had made little sculptures to look at. I'm kind of deviating from your Norman Rockwell question here now.
No, you're fine.
So Gurney would do this, does this too, and Thomas Hart Benton would do that, and I think Gustave Moreau, who was a 19th century symbolist painter, when I was in France with my family, we were at his studio and I saw little sculptures he made that were used for paintings. So you can actually, let's say that I was coming up with this thumbnail sketch of a girl battling some monsters, and I just wanted to visualize it and see it from all different angles in 3D, I could make a really crude little sculpture of some serpentine, wormy-looking thing that would suggest maybe the monster, and then just some little stick figure-y clay blobs to represent the girl maybe, and then move it around and look at it, you know, pick it up and look at it from above, below, maybe light it. That could help me do my thumbnail sketch. Certainly would help me in the very end once I was ready to paint it, because, you know, yeah, you don't ever get a sea monster in front of you and a girl in front of you like that together. It's just like the movies, you know, they make models for that stuff in the movies.
Yeah. And some of your maquettes are very elaborate, like the one of the can't remember the name of the painting now, but it's the one with the woman on the bed with this huge snake. And you made the whole bed and everything. Like, it's
I did.
Quite elaborate.
Well, it wasn't that – I'm trying to remember that one. I think I put that on my blog. I haven't even posted anything that blog in a long time. But I do remember making the snake and making the little bed, because I didn't have the bed and I was looking at photographs of beds and stuff, and I wanted it kind of look like an interesting bed. I don't know if that was a very successful painter. I had done that some time ago. A successful painting, rather, not me.
Yeah, no, I thought it was good. It was great.
Oh, well, thank you.
Do you – I often think in those kind of when I'm thinking of those kind of things myself, I kind of think, oh, I'm sure there's some little computer software program that can make 3D objects that I can just spin them around and I don't have to – do you ever, like, have you ever explored that kind of side of it rather than actually make the physical thing, or do you need to make the physical thing?
Well, there's ZBrush, which I had never learned. I would love to. There's a friend of mine named John Mahoney, an incredible sculptor, and he actually teaches in the classroom next door to me when I teach up at CalArts, when I teach my painting class. He uses ZBrush, and he's a traditional sculptor, but that would be a great one to use, but I don't know how to use it. The one that I have flirted with a little bit and used is, it's called Poser. It's kind of a crudely, you have these little mannequins that are already in the software itself. It's a little easier to use for a guy like me, but you can import things into it. They still look really cheesy. Who is it? There's an Italian guy. He lives in America now for oh gosh, I can't remember his last name. Starts with a V. It's on the tip of my tongue. I should like Google it while I'm talking to you here, Verse something or other. He uses it, I think, or some other 3D program.
Is this Paolo Ventura, is it?
I don't know if it's Ventura. Paolo Ventura?
He's the guy who makes the little models, action figures, and takes photographs of them.
Yeah, I love that guy, though. That guy is great. That guy is fantastic. I have a book of his work. His stuff is so incredible. I actually thought they were real figures when I first saw them. He's an amazing artist. No, this is another guy. He does these like incredible figures falling from the sky, and there might be a helicopter above him, above the figure. And
so you've used that program a little bit.
Poser a little bit. I did have a commission where I had to paint a dragon. I mean, I had too much in this commission. Kids in a flying car and a dragon and stuff. So I sculpted a dragon, and then I tried to put a dragon from Poser into the soft, you know, and move it around.
Yeah.
It's almost easier just to make something out of clay. It's much quicker than to learn how to press all these buttons and commands. Those programs are so complex that it almost is easier just to do it traditionally, I think, for me at least.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I've arrived at the same thing myself. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think the software is caught up. It's not intuitive enough.
It's true. You know, there's people out there that are so good at painting on the computer in these programs like Painter or Photoshop, and it just amazes me. They're good at painting traditionally and painting digitally. Yeah. So, but I am not that good at doing it digitally. I tend to just do better on a tactile surface than using the digital tools. Though I do use Photoshop, yeah. I think that helps to mock things up.
Yeah, me too. Okay, so you've got your idea, you've got your thumbnails. Your thumbnails actually, just when I was looking at the way you do that, your blog is very good actually for your process stuff. They reminded me of animation thumbnails. I don't know whether that's a Rockwell thing or an animation thing, but it reminded me of it.
Thanks. Maybe I learned something at school there.
So you get your models, and sometimes you'll work from life. Is that right? Sometimes you actually paint from life, or is it all you do the photo shoot and then that's it? You just work from the photos.
Well, if I'm just going to paint a portrait of somebody, I can either paint from life. I teach a class where we just paint a la prima from life. That's how I painted for years, especially in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'd always get models and paint from life. I wasn't doing any imaginative work, though. When I started doing this imaginative stuff, it's much easier. If you're doing a girl jumping on a trampoline, you can't paint her from life. You know, somebody in action, let's say, or in movement, it really helps to have a photograph. So I do shoot lots and lots of photos. I don't have any problem with using photography. I mean, there's that famous quote that Norman Rockwell said is, you can't drive a horse and carriage while everybody else is riding in a car. I mean, I guess you could live like I'm not putting Amish down. I love the Amish people. But they live in a very 19th century world, right, where they do not drive in a car. But so it would be too anachronistic to not use modern technology. It would be like somebody saying, well, Louis Pasteur, I admire Louis Pasteur so much, I'm not going to be a doctor and use any of the modern information we've learned about health now. I'm just going to stay back and not inoculate myself. I don't know. It's a bad analogy maybe, but –
Yeah, no, I get what you mean.
I think we got to be in the world today using the technology that we have.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why it's so lovely when you see somebody who is a brilliant classical painter and they're really good at the digital stuff as well. There's something I think particularly special about that.
There is. I mean, there's a guy who goes by the handle Good Brush. Good Brush, I should look that up too, but he's a great painter and he can paint traditionally, but he paints digitally just like a traditional painter would. It just blows me away every time I see his work.
Yeah. Who did I have on? Jane Radstrom. She can do that. She's really good at both. Very good. She does mostly classical now, but saw some of her digital paintings. Brilliant.
Is she she's the young woman that went to Germany. She moved to Berlin, Germany.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
I tried to find some of her digital stuff, but I couldn't. But I'm really impressed by her traditional work. I mean, amazing painter.
Pastels are
really inspiring stuff. Craig Mullins, have you ever heard of him? Mullins. No. If you look him up, it's under www.goodbrush.com. His stuff is like, wow, it'll floor you, the kind of paintings this guy does. He works with the movies and everything.
Okay. Actually, the surname sounds familiar, but often I'll know the stuff if I see it. Yeah, I might know the person's name. Okay, so do you do color studies and value studies?
Yeah, definitely for the complicated imaginative paintings, I always do that. Once I've got all the photos, the photo reference shot, I used to just then put all the photo reference up on a board, you know, all these different photos, because I don't use just one picture. I use many, many, many photographs and a hand from here, an arm from there. And Norman Rockwell would then do what he called a comprehensive charcoal drawing and putting all the reference together. Then I started seeing that a lot of illustrators and artists doing this stuff were Frankensteining the photos up in Photoshop. They would, instead of doing the comprehensive charcoal drawing, they would kind of put it all together in Photoshop. And there's an artist named Donatello Giannacola. Do you know who he is?
No.
He's an amazing painter. And he that's where I saw the first person to do that. Then a guy named Glenn Orbick, this really incredible painter, who unfortunately recently passed away too young. He would do that with his reference.
Yeah, I know his work. It's brilliant.
Oh, yeah, he's great. And I got the opportunity to be in one of his classes and study with him and his girlfriend, which her name all of a sudden, Laurel. Anyway, he's a great artist. I'll think of her last name in a moment. And it's just sad that he passed away, Glenn Orbick. But yeah, he would do that. Yeah. He would put all the photos together. And in fact, he did it traditionally at first in a way. He would like Xerox the photos before he ever used Photoshop and kind of cut and paste them up and glue them or together. But I'm glad that you're familiar with him. He's Blechman, good. Laurel Blechman. That's her name. She's really a great artist too. They both would work together on the same picture and paint together. Okay. And I guess it would then be put under the name of Glenn Orbick, but they would do a collaborative kind of a painting.
Oh, nice. Just hang on a sec. Just want to go back to your color studies. When I was looking at your process shots, you don't just do one color study. You do like, three or four, and the colors are very different. You really are like trying out the different color combinations and how it's all going to work together.
Yeah, that's what I've tried to do. Well, I learned that from Norman Rockwell. So he had this friend named Mead Schaefer. Have you ever heard of Mead Schaefer? Really incredible painterly painter, if you ever look him up. He had this great career, and they were friends. And his wife said, why don't you just use your charcoal drawing, photograph this charcoal drawing that you did, reduce it down, and then paint on top of it for your color studies, just for your color studies. In other words, he would do this charcoal drawing. This is how Norman Rockwell did it. And then he'd take a photograph of that charcoal study, so his own drawing, and then reduce it down, and then he'd do his color sketches on top of it, just so he could figure out how to do the colors. So I started doing that. I would do the complete charcoal drawing. Then I would do a grisaille on the canvas. And then I take a picture of it. And then I might just print it out on typing paper, a bunch of them, like 3x4. Yeah. So that's my own painting. So I don't want anyone to think I'm painting on top of a photograph, because that's not what I'm saying I do. I photograph my painting, which is then monochromatic. And then I'm doing a color study on top of it, because if you didn't do it that way, it'd just be a lot of extra work. You want to get it done fast, so just paint on top of that thing on typing paper, or if you want to give it away to somebody later, you could put some varnish on it or a shellac on it to preserve it, and then paint on top of it quickly. And then I'd explore different colors. I might say, well, okay, let's do a realistic one. And then when I started reading Gurney's books, he has something called a controlled gamut, where you can take sections of a color wheel and just make a small sliver of a color wheel, the total color wheel, just cut out a lot of it and just use an area of it, maybe even find an accent. So you could paint everything in blues, maybe have an accent of yellow. But his book, Color and Light, he goes over that in quite a lot of detail on how to make these controlled color gamuts. I thought, wow, that's such an interesting thing. So I learned a lot from his books too. So I've kind of put Rockwell and James Gurney together a lot for some of my methods.
Yeah, no, that's a great tip about the color studies. And you've got a picture of that color gamut thing as well. It's very interesting. It's kind of like a wing, a cross section of a wing. It's got that kind of shape to it, doesn't it? An airplane wing.
Yeah, and you can use whatever shape you want. In his book, Color and Light, James Gurney goes over that. He'll take a color wheel, the Yerby color wheel, and he shows how you can then put an overlay over the color wheel and use any kind of shape you want. It can even be random, and you just kind of move it around and you go, oh, I kind of would like to experiment with this small area. It's a way of giving yourself a limited palette, but not just using, let's say, raw umber, blue, and you're just using these limited palettes of pigments, but you can also look at a color wheel and limit your palette to a certain area of the color wheel. And he has some really cool videos and stuff on his blog, and on it's his blog, where you and YouTube channel that you or anybody, if you haven't ever gone to James Gurney, or it's the Gurney Journey rather, it's a great resource for artists. He's just a great artist. He's a really wonderful human being as well. And so I've met him a couple of times and been to some of his lectures.
Brilliant. Okay, I'll put a link in the show notes for it then. Good. Speaking of palettes, do you have a favorite kind of palette that you always like to use or start from?
You know, lately now I'm just – because I'll use anything. I used to be very like, okay, I always use this one palette. And way back when I was just painting still life and I don't want anyone to think I'm dismissing still life when I say just still life, because I just want to mention here that I love that guy, David Chaifetz, that you interviewed. I've been a huge fan of his work. His still lifes just blew me away, what he does. I want to start doing some still life again from life. But when I was not doing the imaginative work, I used this really giant palette that had all these colors on it. And I was painting very chromatically when I lived in New Mexico, flowers and fruit. And since then, since I had that break and I went into the imaginative work and I started experimenting with limited palettes, and I got kind of a critique from my friend Walt. He said, you know, you're using too much color. So I started limiting my palette. I guess that what I'm trying to do these days is limit my color selection and make it a little smaller than I used to. So I sometimes might only use three colors, and other times I'll use more. But lately it's pretty much like a cad orange, cad red, cad yellow, ultramarine blue, yellow ochre, and white. Maybe I'll throw a Mars black in there, or an ivory black, or an alizarin crimson sometimes as well. But, you know, lately, too, I've been aware of the chemical colors being cancer-causing and poisonous. And since I teach a painting class, I've been trying to talk about that with my students. So I actually found substitutes for the cadmiums that are pretty good that I've been experimenting with. There's a Windsor orange and a Scarlet Lake that aren't poisonous anymore. That aren't poison. They don't have cadmiums in them, at least, which I think might be important not to use.
No, it's good to know. I noticed that you had a go at using a parallel palette. How have you found that?
I love that parallel palette. Well, I liked Kassan's work. He's great. He's a very tight painter. Very impressive. I don't think I could paint as tight as him, but I really admire his skill. I'm kind of more turned on by a looser type of a painting, which he can do as well. But I really respect his work, and I thought, wow, what a cool invention, because that palette is up against the picture, and you can – you know, it's in the exact same light as your painting. And so I've experimented with, and it's a little small. I'd say the mixing area is a little small for me, but for doing a little painting from life quickly in like 3 hours or 4 hours or something like that, it's not a bad thing to have. You have to have a little more paraphernalia for it. You have to have a tripod to put it on. So sometimes I just, when I'm teaching my class, I'll bring it. Other times I just use just a little palette that I have sitting down on the little sawhorse things that we have in our class to paint on.
Right.
But the parallel palette's a pretty cool invention. It's pretty neat. Have you used it at all?
No, I haven't. No, it was just coming out when he was on the podcast. It was, you know, it was going to come out, I think, in a couple of months, and then and when it came out, everybody was talking about it. But I haven't actually talked to anyone who used one, so I was just curious.
Yeah, it's great. And talking about Gurney again, he uses a little easel he invented, which isn't made for commercial. It's not put out commercially, but it's a do-it-yourself kind of a little easel that you can stick on a tripod that you can then attach a notebook to, a sketchbook, so you can paint in gouache, let's say, or watercolor out from life. And I made one of those, so when I go out on trips, I take it with me, and that attaches to a tripod as well. It's a little different than the parallel palette, but it has a little magnet, so you can actually stick a little magnetic tray on there for use with water media and stuff. And so I've got one of those too. I made that one, though I'm not so good at making stuff like that out of wood, but I just followed his directions.
Right. If you're enjoying this podcast, remember you can support it by going to patreon.com/JohnDalton gently does it. Okay, this is another question. This is from artist Colia Evans, and she says two things. Number one, favorite brushes slash bristle.
Well, sometimes I use those hog's hair bristle brushes, I guess the traditional brush. Now I'll use synthetic ones. I went through a period when everything is like pre-imaginative painting. When I got the opportunity to study with Richard Schmidt a long, long time ago, just in a workshop, and he would always push these mongoose brushes made from the hair of a mongoose. I sort of always felt bad for the poor little mongooses. He's like an incredible painter, mm-hmm. though, and he used those. And so, but now I don't use anything like that. I just use those. I think they're called brights. They look like little square shape or a big square shape. I like the brights. And Dick Blick has like a line of these synthetic brushes. They're not very expensive, and you can use them for acrylic, for gouache, or for oil. And I like those. I just like that. And I like them really to keep that razor sharp edge along them. So the bristle, yeah. Hog's hair bristle ones, they seem to deteriorate after a while. I try to wash them as well as I can. I really try to be fastidious and wash my brushes after I use them every day. I'll go in here and tell my wife, I got to wash my brushes. Then I go in here and I start painting instead of washing them. And then finally I'll wash them. But yeah, they could be anything, but I do like a well-preserved or taken care of brush. If they get too crappy, I can't make a good brush stroke for them. So they need to be really sharp. And there's this artist named Ignat Ignatov. I took a little class with him one time when I was trying to warm up again with painting from life. And he's a really great painter. And he would take those brushes if they got all screwed up. Once you wash them and they're wet and they're kind of getting splayed, he'd take a piece of cardboard and grip the wet brush between those and put a little clip on it. And after it dried, they'd be all perfectly flat again. It was kind of a way of fixing those brushes that have gotten a little frayed or messed up. I don't know if that helps anybody.
Well, that's a good tip. Now, her second part is number two. What kind of combination do you use for your medium, i.e. poppy seed oil, linseed, and et cetera?
I'm not using any linseed oil. I've been using odorless mineral spirits by Gamsol, and I've been putting a little Galkut in there, and that's all I use. Though I did experiment with a little walnut oil a couple months ago in there too. But mostly it's just odorless mineral spirits and a little shot of Galkut so it dries a little faster. Sometimes I've used Liquin as well.
Right.
That's all I use. I used to use Damar linseed terps, but not anymore.
Is that because of the fumes or?
It was a long time ago. That was the traditional medium I think that they'd always suggest was use a little. But I've heard that Damar varnish isn't so good. So I thought, well, that Galkut is a little more of a modern material. Seemed like it just makes the painting really. I don't know. I can't sound very scientific here in how I describe it, but it seemed like from some of the reading I did that was a good thing to use now. So that's why I started using it, either Liquin or Galkut.
All right. How do you check yourself as you're working? I know you've got all the pictures up, but how do you your reference pictures up? How do you check yourself? Do you jump back and forth from the canvas? Do you turn it upside down? Use mirrors, or what's your particular way?
Well, ever since I've been a student, I'm still a student. Ever since I've been learning art, I always heard about the mirror, and I've always used a mirror and a little hand mirror, and I just hold it up to my eyes and look at the image reversed. And even Leonardo da Vinci in his notebooks talks about using a mirror. I figured if it's good enough for Leonardo, it's probably good enough for me or for anybody. It seems like the best way is a mirror, the most traditional old information. I mean, if it comes down from Leonardo da Vinci, who lived in the Renaissance and was a scientist and everything, I figure that's a pretty good indication of something to use. I mean, another great tool is to have somebody come in and just look at it for you. You have to trust them, obviously, because you have to take everything with a grain of salt. But Leonardo also talks about that. says that anybody can tell you if the painting is off, that a nose is too long or ears too short or something like that. And that's why he says it's good to paint in the company of other people, I guess, when you're just drawing from life. But I think a mirror is really great. I heard when I listened to the David Chaffetz podcast, it was interesting. He said just squinting for him was how he did it. So after I heard that, I started like just trying to squint more at both things and see if that would help me. And I thought, oh, maybe that helps too. Sight size. You know what? Working sight size helps me a lot if I'm working from photos. If what I'm working from is the same size as what I'm painting, that's easier for me to see my mistakes. It's the same if I'm working from life. If I paint sight size, if I paint what I see, the size I perceive it on the canvas, then I can look back and forth from nature to the canvas, and it's easier for me to catch my mistakes. If I enlarge it too much, I can't catch my mistakes as well, but the mirror as well too helps a lot. So I'd say sight size is another good tool.
Do you have a favorite piece of equipment or medium or paint or just something you just really love?
This isn't something I've been using forever, but I started getting into this certain canvas that I like to use. That's, it's acrylic Frederick's style 190 DP. Actually, I got this from Greg Manchester, but I've just loved it since I've started using it. What I like about it is it comes in rolls and it's already prepared, so you can cut it off exactly the size you want it. And I've just been taping it to a board. I don't even stretch it up. I just make sure I leave enough room that if it comes out okay, I can stretch it. And then you can stick it in a drawer or something later because it's not on stretcher bars. Or also, it's a good way – that's another way to check yourself, by the way, I just remembered, is just putting it away in a drawer or something so you don't see it for a while and work on something else and come back. But I do like this canvas.
Yeah.
So if I had to think of something that I really like, this stuff is great stuff by Frederick's. And it comes in 52-inch by 6 yards.
Wow. In a 1991 interview that you gave for the Santa Fe magazine, you said, "Through my painting, I've realized that I'm learning to know myself." So I was just wondering how that's going, because, you know, that's quite a while ago. And has that how that process of learning to know yourself through your painting has been going for you?
That's a good question. And it's funny, I don't remember saying that, but I do know those. I put a couple of those articles up from way back then. That was when I was doing my before I start doing the more imaginative stuff. I think that my journey through painting is making me a lot more humble. I mean, I know how hard – it's so much harder, I think, in a way. Even though I feel like I've become more skillful in some ways, I feel like I was very rusty when I started again after I had just gone into animation. In 2009, when I got back to the painting, I think what is it teaching about myself? Just that I have so much to learn, maybe always, that the journey doesn't stop. It doesn't end. It's just continuous. It's fun, but it can drive you crazy. It can drive me crazy. I don't know if that's a good answer, but that's all I can think of right now of what it seems to be for me.
Well, why it kind of stood out for me was, as you said, like in the early 90s, you're painting still lifes and figures, and it's all lovely. And then there's the big gap when you're in animation, and then, you know, when you come back to it, you're painting all this retro fairy tale devil pinup girl stuff, and that change, that big change, on top of this thing, which, you know, as a much younger man, you were saying, through painting, I've realized I'm learning to know myself. I was curious to know, as you looked at what you're now painting and the journey that you've gone through, what you now have learned to know about yourself.
You know, maybe I'm being more transparent about who I am with the subject matter that I'm painting. I mean, I do love to paint pinup girls. I like the sexuality, the evocativeness of it. I like dark subject matter. Maybe I'm learning that. I love to just do this kind of a thing. I mean, I'm so grateful that I can wake up in the morning and that I have the opportunity to make these crazy things and put them out. And it seems like some people like to look at them even. So there's maybe a small audience. Maybe I'm learning I'm a little more multifaceted than I thought I was. I don't know. I don't really know what I was discovering about myself when I look at myself back then when I lived in New Mexico or Oklahoma, New Mexico, when I was painting, you know, beautiful florals and I was painting a pretty girl or a guy with a bandana on or an interior or a landscape. What was I learning about myself then? I don't really know. I don't know what I meant when I said that. Maybe I just had to say something that sounded meaningful. I don't know.
There's always that.
Learning more about maybe I'm learning more about myself now because I am painting things that are, I don't know, they excite me. I mean, I feel like it's more of who I am. I have to say that I feel like I have more collectors now, or maybe I'm more proud of the collectors collecting this stuff because it is much more personal. I'm not saying that every picture is as personal as it could be, but I feel like I'm painting more who I am somehow, even though they're kind of weird things. Like, I don't know how I am a picture of a couple girls floating up to a flying saucer. But I don't know. It feels more authentic than somehow paint. I think that because I grew up, my mother painted. She painted still life. The first thing I could ever remember her painting was a Renoir copy. And my mom and dad loved that stuff. They collected Richard Schmidt. They collected Hettinger, people that – I mean, I grew up in a world pre-internet. There was only a few realistic painters I even knew about. I don't know. That was just this world that I grew up in, and it was kind of confining. I think once I started just doing what I wanted to do and I said, fuck this. I'm going to paint what I like. I think I always wanted to paint what I like, but I felt like I couldn't somehow. Like maybe I was being constrained or held back. So I don't know what I meant about that I was learning about myself. I think I've learned that I was holding myself back maybe now, possibly.
When you were saying about the painting girls being pulled up into a spaceship, I was just reminded of something I heard John Curran. You know John Curran, that painter?
Oh, yeah. He's great. John Curran. Just saw a show of his, not too long. Maybe it was a year ago at a gallery here in Los Angeles and around Beverly Hills. Yeah, amazing stuff.
So he was asked, you know, well, what does it mean and whatever? And he said, that's all me. You know, all the men in the pictures are me. All the women in the pictures are me. It's all me. Huh? Which I thought was great.
That's interesting. That's very Jungian, because doesn't Carl Jung say that when you're having a dream, every character in your dream, when I read Man and His Symbols, he'd say that you're every character in your unconscious. If it's a woman – because it's your brain that's making this dream. So maybe there's a lot of truth to that, even though you are using an external model for it. There's a bit of you in all those characters, I suppose. I never thought of it that way. That's an interesting thing that he'd say. I never heard that before.
You do meditation, is that right?
Oh, I've tried to do meditation. Where did you hear that? I've tried to do meditation.
I don't know. I read it somewhere. You said you did it.
Well, here's what I do. Because I still battle insomnia some nights. I mean, like last night, I slept great. But I mean, usually I wake up about 3 in the morning and I can't go back to sleep right away. So I'll read a little bit. But when I do try to fall asleep, I do this meditation that I read about that this Dr. Andrew Weil, W-E-I-L. Have you ever heard of him? Mm-hmm. Weil. He's a holistic health doctor, and he has something, I think he calls it the 4-7-8, if I'm not incorrect on this, where you breathe in for 4 seconds, hold it for 7 seconds, then breathe out for 8 seconds. So I practiced that at night, and before that I was trying to do this mindful meditation kind of a thing in the middle of the night too, where I might just count down from a large number, because I realized if I just counted from 100, then I'm still awake. So I'd start with like 536, let's say, and I'll just breathe in deeply, and then I think backwards, and I visualize the numbers. Like they might be actually made out of granite or wood, or they're giant. And I'm looking up at them, so I see 538, and it's this giant, massive granite numbers. And then I'm breathing in, and then it's 537. And then I keep going, and hopefully somewhere in there I've fallen asleep. But that's the only kind of meditation I do. I've tried to do it when I'm awake. I really want to do it because I'm a huge David Lynch fan, and I have read so much about his meditation. And I thought, wow, man, if I could come up with ideas like David Lynch, man, I'd really be rocking. But I can't seem to get the discipline to do that kind of meditation. And I know he does a transcendental meditation, so it might be different than mindful meditation.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
My wife is doing meditation. Do you meditate? Are you doing a mindful meditation or any – what kind of meditation do you do?
Well, because I was a craniosacral therapist for a long time, that's kind of like – that requires a lot of meditation, deep kind of meditation. So it's basically like when you get right down to it, meditation is kind of about turning your mind off and whatever – you know, there's lots of different roads to that, but that's the end product, is you're just not thinking really. So I'll kind of – that's kind of where I'm at now, is I'll just sit down and I'll just stop thinking for as long as I can. And that could be maybe 10 seconds, 20 seconds. It's, you know, if you can stop thinking for 20 seconds, that's a long time internally. But I might do that for maybe, you know, 20 minutes or something like that. Just keep returning to that, thinking kind of that, you know.
How do you get into your meditative state? Is it through breathing, like what I've read mindful meditation is, or is it through a mantra?
No, I don't use a mantra. I did a TM, or transcendental meditation, years and years ago. So they give you a mantra when you do that, and it's fine. I'm not putting it down. It's just not for me. For me, it was much more. I was more interested in not making my brain, kind of hypnotizing your brain into stopping, which is kind of what a mantra does. I was more interested in directly into that kind of mysterious space of no thought, not thinking, you know. But just what you reminded me of there is I recently came across Wim Hof's breathing technique. And it's funny you should mention David Chavitz, because he's a big fan of it as well. And he's the guy he's called the Iceman, and he does all these stunts of where he immerses himself in ice for crazy, you know, 2 hours in an ice bath, and he swims under glaciers and all that kind of thing. Not that interested in that side of it, but the breathing,
cool.
The breathing thing is very good. Yeah, it is. Well, what's interesting about his stuff is that he's has it all proved scientifically. So he, you know, lets the scientists come and put all the monitors on him. And he's basically got control of his autonomic nervous system, the side of your nervous system that you normally don't have control over. So he can regulate his heartbeat, and he can regulate his body temperature and do all sorts of pretty incredible things. And his breathing technique is pretty easy to do. And it's, I'll put a link, I'll send you a link, but I'll put a link in the show notes as well. For how he goes about it.
Oh, fantastic. You know what? I just did a search for him. There's a picture of him with ice in his beard, and he's cross-legged in some snow. Wim Hof method. I see. Well, I've never heard of him.
So
I've been taking notes during this whole thing, because you always bring up interesting stuff here.
Yeah, he's a bit of a crazy
man.
And
I didn't know you were
a
cranial psychotherapist.
Sacral, yeah, sacral, S-A-C-R-A-L.
Sacral, cranial sacral.
Yeah,
sacral.
Cranials, yeah, head to tail.
Okay, sacrum, that's what I said, wow.
So, yeah, the Wim Hof stuff actually might be good for the old insomnia, if it's still going on.
You know what, I'll take anything to help me sleep better, because it's so important, you know. I feel like that's one of my biggest challenges in a way, is at night, because at around 3 in the morning, I think you call it the hour of the wolf. I mean, the demons seem to come out for me at that period. They're all sitting, you know, like Fuseli's The Nightmare. They're all hanging out on my stomach and around the pillow.
Wow. Do you go asleep and wake up at that time, or you just can't get to sleep?
I can get to sleep easily. I fall asleep really well, and I exercise during the day, and I cut off my coffee around 12 o'clock. So I don't have any more caffeine, you know, from 12 on. I've learned to do that. But a lot of times just at 3:30 or so, I just tend to wake up. I read about something called the second sleep that in medieval period, there was something called second sleep, and people would wake up and do things for a little while at some point in the night, visit people, pray or something like that. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, it's there's lots of different schools of thought on it. Like if you were talking to a Chinese medicine practitioner, they can tell you they relate it to your organs. You know, like they might say, oh, that if it's 3 o'clock you wake up, that's your liver, or if it's 4 o'clock, oh, that's your spleen or whatever. I mean, I'm not saying that that's the way it is, but that's how they think of it. And there are other schools of thought that say you got to get up. You're no point lying in bed trying to go back asleep. If you wake up, get up. Go downstairs for 10 minutes, and then when you come back to bed, you'll fall asleep again. There's a whole lot of science about looking at your phone or any kind of device. It emits this kind of blue light, and you can apparently it disrupts your production of melanin for, I think, 4 hours after, you know, from looking at your phone before you go to sleep. So it actually makes it really hard for you to go to sleep. But you can get apps to switch over. It takes all the blue light out of your monitors or your iPad or your phone or anything like that. That all helps, that kind of stuff as well. So, yeah, there's lots of, you know, I think I had heard of that medieval thing as well. Not a lot about it, but, yeah, it sounds familiar.
Yeah, I knew about the devices, and I try to limit that kind of a thing as well. But, you know, generally I'm sleeping pretty well these days, but I still do have to do that breathing technique a lot of times after I do go get back, and then I'll usually fall asleep unless I've got something terribly bothering me. You know, sometimes even like this week on Tuesday I teach, and I had the first class, and for some reason I always feel a little bit of oh my God, first class, will I do okay? I'm going to demonstrate. I had to do two demonstrations, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. And so as it would happen, I was completely sleep deprived, and I did these two portraits, but they came out okay. I don't know how I did them, whether it's just some sort of automatic thing or they come out, but I'm painting from life and it worked, but it's just weird to have people watching me. And in the old days, I even did portraits and festivals and things. I had no problem with that, but I guess it's different now for me.
Right.
But the trepidation of having to do that the next day, for some reason, I think, kept me wide awake.
Right. Yeah. So are these the current pictures that you're doing from imagination, are they moving for you to create? Like, you know, I generally ask people, like, what's the most kind of moving picture? What stands out for them? But I'm just kind of curious, do you relate to the current kind of pictures that you're doing in that way?
Yeah, I think sometimes they are. I can get caught up in them. I mean, they definitely keep me engaged. I think I'm very engaged when I do them. I'm very totally interested in that sense. Are they moving emotionally? I think they are. I mean, if it starts to become real for me, I might chuckle or laugh as I'm doing it. I go, oh, yeah, that's cool. I feel like I'm getting something here. I don't know if that answers that question.
All right. Is there one that stands out for you that's more emotional than the others?
I don't know if there's one that stands out more than the others, to tell you the truth, because I think it's the one that I'm working on at the moment. And then you have to go on to the next, and I don't think about it so much anymore because now, all right, that's done. I want to try to do better. I want to make something more interesting. I want to go on from there. So I don't think there's anything that I've done that I look back and go, oh, yeah, because I mean, in a weird way, I feel like I'm just beginning again, because I didn't start painting my imaginative paintings until it had to be around 2009. I just jumped back into this, where I wasn't painting traditionally every day. I mean, I was drawing and painting things, but a lot of it was animation. I did some gouache paintings, gouache still lifes, I think, in 2003 from life, right when my daughter was born. So I would go – it's very sporadically was I really painting, but now since 2009, it's been just like, man, I've just had this flow of like stuff pouring out of me, and I feel so grateful. And I knock on wood, I'm going to knock on some wood. I hope it keeps happening because it's scary that it might stop or something. And so I guess it's just working every day and making sure to keep the gears greased. And, you know, it's like, again, David Chaffetz comes up because he's a big fan of Pressman, and I've been a big fan of Pressman as well. I have The War of Art. I have it on tape, not tape, but I have it on MP3. I have it as a book. I've had to reread it several times. I've had to listen to it when I've had problems working. And so that question just brings up to me that I don't think there's anything that just sticks in my mind that is like my most meaningful or emotional painting. But I think that I just want to keep making pictures that are meaningful, and hopefully I can keep having stuff flowing out of me through the universe, because I really think by working you get in touch with the muse. And that's what I like about Pressman. He talks about that if you don't paint every day, if you don't do your writing or whatever it is that you are meant to be, even if you're an entrepreneur, if you don't do your entrepreneuring every day and work at it, then the muse doesn't come to you. It doesn't, you don't get your flow. You know, it comes through me. And he also says, thank the muse, you know, pray to the muse while you're working. I tell that to my students. It sounds really insane, possibly, maybe very mumbo jumbo-y, but I really do believe that there's a higher power or a spirit of the universe. A magic, a vibration that's coming through us. And by doing that work, it opens it up. Without doing it, it doesn't happen. And by just doing it every day and practicing or trying to do a little bit every day, it might even just be an hour if that's all you can make. But then somehow that stuff comes in of our brain or we're visited by the muse or the goddess of art or the god of art, whatever it is.
Yep, very good. As I said at the beginning, you've had a long association with the entertainment industry. You've created art for, you know, as you said, TV shows like Dexter and Medium, and you have celebrity collectors like Mel Brooks and Jason Segel and Jack Black. Did I leave anybody out?
I don't think so. I don't think I have that many famous collectors today, okay. But a few, because, probably because I just live in Los Angeles, you know, that helps a lot because a lot of those people are out here.
Yeah. So you're kind of right in Hollywood. And how do you think that working in Hollywood has influenced you as an artist?
Well, I live in the Venice Beach area, so I'm not right in Hollywood, but I mean, you're close because, you know, you can just drive there. I guess the way it's influenced me is that because there's so many people that work in the entertainment industry here. I mean, you mentioned that you used to work in animation and you worked on the camera and you did writing. I mean, there's so many people like you that do that kind of work. So the people that work on the cameras, people that work on sets, people that write. There's so many of them. So you take your kid to school and there's somebody that has another kid at school, a parent, and they're actually maybe a big director. So you come in contact with those people, or somebody walks by and you go, oh my God, that's so-and-so. So they're just there, and you know they're in the entertainment industry. I mean, you're just rubbing shoulders with people just because they're in this town with you. So it's closer to you, and it's such a big you know, people make such a big deal of it. It's such a big art form. It's not like – I mean, it's like maybe – in Paris in the 19th century, artists would exhibit at the Salon, and that was like us going to the movies today. We went and we'd walk through the Salon. You'd see a painting by Constable or Sargent. It would depend on what year you're there, right? Or Delacroix. And you go, oh man, Delacroix, look at that movie. It's like a movie in a way, a Delacroix, The Massacre at Chios. So today, you know, you see a movie and you take your kid to school, and this person, you know, made a movie. They are a director, and you just happen to know that they made this movie. So that kind of affects you in a sense. It's also closer to you. You see people making this stuff, and they are real people. And they have kids and they have lives. So it's just a part of your life. And so, for instance, me even getting that job on some of those TV shows just comes from that, because like my wife knew a guy that just happened to be a set – what do they call that? The person that finds the sets. I can't remember what they call that job.
Location scout?
location person or something like that. And they just happened to walk into our house. They were having dinner with us or something. And they saw my painting. He says, "Oh my gosh, we're looking for an artist." He worked on Medium, and we're looking for an artist. "I like your stuff better than the guy we were looking at or something. And would you be interested?" And so I got a job just from that, just by an accidental thing where a person walked into the house. So that's how it's affected me, just in a very mundane way, that you're in this town. And so the opportunity for those things to happen can happen, where they wouldn't happen if I lived still in Oklahoma, let's say, because I would never have had that person walk into my house and see the paintings. So it could have happened to anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, I had to be an artist at the same time that maybe he would like. But the opportunity is there, I think, just because you are in this town, I think, and the industry is here.
Okay. What's the biggest challenge you're facing at the moment as an artist?
Getting back to work and trying to work every day. I had some work done in my studio, and I was getting back, and I had to move everything in. I have all these boxes in here, and I was moving stuff in right before Christmas and then unpacking and trying to get it all together. And it was like that Pressman thing. You got to work every day. So I said, all right, I've got to make myself a challenge. I'm going to do a portrait every day. It wasn't really an imaginative picture, but I just need to get to work. So I've been doing that, just painting a portrait no matter what is happening in my life, unpacking or taking my daughter to school or picking her up or having some family thing to do at the end of the day, walking the dog. I'm going to paint for a certain amount of time and paint a portrait. And if I have time, I'll paint two portraits. So that's been my biggest challenge, just the most biggest one happening in my immediate life, is I just need to get to work and get that flow going again. And I'm trying to think of ideas for more bigger storytelling pictures as well.
Bigger stories or physically bigger canvases?
No, not so much bigger canvases, because I've learned – I mean, I sell some of them, and if you do really big ones, then they don't sell, and I have to have a place to put these big things. But no, I just want to get back to also doing some imaginative paintings again, and I was kind of feeling – you know, after I moved in here from – I had a temporary studio at the Santa Monica Airport, sharing a studio with another artist, because I had to get out of here when I was having some flat files put in and stuff like that. And when I got back and moved in, I just felt empty. I was like, I don't know if I have any ideas. And I felt like I just need to get back in the flow of painting, just to let the muse in, let the stuff start to flow in.
Right. So you mentioned your daughter, bringing your daughter to school. This is my final question to do with future generations. That's what your daughter reminded me of it there. And it's this thing of, if there's one thing that you could pass on to future generations, what do you think it would be?
Yeah, I've heard you ask that one too. God, and every time I've listened to all these artists say such interesting things, and every time I heard that question, I've drawn a blank, like I'm doing now. What would I pass on to future generations? It's a hard question. I don't know if I feel like a kind of person that could pass something on to a future generation. I don't know if I have anything to pass on that's of worth. It sounds so lofty. What can I pass on to future generations, you know? I don't know. I don't even remember what other artists have said, to tell you the truth. I think when I heard that question before, I had a cold panic. So I don't know what I have to pass on to a future generation. Except my daughter, maybe. You know?
No, she's the generation. What are you going to pass on to her?
Oh my gosh, you know, work. She's got this amazing work ethic. If I can just talk about my daughter, she amazes me. And this ability to, my God, she seems to have memorized the whole Hamilton music CD. As I was taking her to school today, she was just singing along to Hamilton. I was like, God, how did she just could rap along with it. But that's what my wife and I have seemed to pass on to her. She's just got this amazing brain and of course, she's my daughter, so I admire her a lot.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm going to pass on to another generation. Boy, I hope I can keep living long enough so maybe I will have something I could pass on. You know, maybe one of the things that makes me want to create is I know that one day I'm going to die and I'm not going to be here and I want to leave something. And, you know, I told that to somebody at a party and they said, well, that's just futile thinking. You know, how do you know your stuff will even exist after you're gone? And oh my God, he was really it was really kind of depressing the way he put it. I just felt like, well, you know, if you at least sell a few of them, you're hoping that some of them might last. Maybe that's how I could answer that question. Maybe I'm trying. Maybe it is futile, but I'm painting these scraps of canvas, these odd-shaped rectangular things with paint smeared on, and then I'm hoping above hope that maybe when I'm gone, a few of them are going to last in somebody's house somewhere.
It's funny you should say all that about your work lasting, because you probably know there was the fire in the RJD gallery in Sag Harbor just before Christmas, and it was
I saw that.
It's quite a few of the artists represented by that gallery who had been on the podcast. I wrote a thing about it. I was kind of moved to write a thing about it. It was all about those kind of themes that you were talking about, because I had Connor Walton on very early on, and he was basically like, oh, well, you know, in 1,000 years, none of the paintings are going to be around. The, you know, canvas just won't last that long. That's one kind of perspective on it.
But I don't know if that's true. I did see that article, and I don't know if my post made it in the blog. I posted how horrible I felt for those artists, and I could relate. And I didn't write this because I felt it would be too egocentric to put my own experience into that little post. But I had something similar happen to my own work. I have a storage unit here in the Venice Beach area, and I still have it. But since before I had it now, there was a big fire in the storage unit. Everybody's stuff burned up, and I lost about 30 paintings. So I know what it is to lose your work. It's like it just evaporates. And the insurance paid for – I mean, I had all those images that were in my movie Night Sweats. I had like 4 boxes of drawings. Those all burnt. And then all my records, phonograph records, high school, all my Frank Zappa records, all my Beatles records. I mean, 4 boxes of records also burnt up, became plastic. Nobody died, thank God. Nobody got hurt. The firemen, there were no people in there. But when you lose your paintings, it's horrible. So I can really feel for the – even if I hadn't lost it, I would still feel for those artists. But it's horrible. They just evaporate. It's like having a one-man show and selling everything, but you don't have it all anymore. And I don't even think I had a record of some of the paintings. Some of them weren't even that good of paintings. They were early stuff. But it was stuff that I had like taken off of stretchers and rolled up. And so I feel for those artists, and I saw some of the paintings that like Pamela had that were just incredible. She's such an incredible artist. I know she was on your podcast. I listened to hers, and I loved what she had to say about her art. And I love her work, and I can't imagine losing some of the paintings that she – like those paintings that she did were just – wow. I couldn't imagine losing those in the fire. But I don't – you know – yes, maybe some of our stuff will get destroyed in 1,000 years, but look at the stuff that's still lasting of Leonardo's. Of course, his stuff is great. You know, my stuff might end up on the garbage heap. Who knows what will happen? You know, maybe some stuff will get buried, or maybe the digital stuff will remain. I don't know. I guess it is kind of futile or egocentric to think that your stuff might last one day, but maybe that's what makes me want to do it. It's like you want to leave a part of yourself here. So probably that's what makes me want to paint. I mean, it's not the only thing that makes me want to paint, but I do want to leave something of myself. I don't know if every artist feels that way, but there must be something of that. I mean, does that motivate you to write or to paint the pictures that you paint at all, to have them last? Like,
no.
No, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't motivate.
No, not at all.
Interesting.
Well, I take a very practical, an experiential view on life. And like for me, life ends every night when I go to sleep, and it starts again when I wake up. And that's what I know. And you know, death is just a bit of an idea. You know, I don't know what it's going to be like. So even if I did kind of entertain the idea of leaving something behind me, I'm not going to be around to experience that. So I don't really think about it like that.
Well, I don't either. I mean, I don't fantasize about, my paintings existing when I'm dead. I think I just want to, I guess, I don't want it to end right now. I mean, when I wake up in the morning and go, yay, I'm still here. I mean, it's fun to be here. I really like being around. It's such an amazing thing to be on the planet. So I hope I can have another you know, long time while I am still here and can paint and have my brain, do it, because it's a great opportunity. But yeah, one day it is going to end. It's weird to think what will happen, though, you know, when you're not here to experience it and you're not going to have consciousness anymore. And you think of your friends, some of them that aren't here anymore, not being around. It's weird. It's a weird thing.
Yeah. Well, wherever we go, or wherever I go when I go to sleep, it's good because I wake up refreshed. So I'm not too, I mean, ask me on my deathbed, but right now I'm not too, you know, afraid of it wherever I go.
Maybe I can have that attitude more. Sometimes I think being the night when I wake up, the middle of the night, it is a scary thing. I know that sounds bizarre. I don't know if that's a good thing for me to admit. I sound like a little child or something. Maybe it's my dreams and things. I do enjoy dreaming, and I love dreaming. I know the unconscious is a crazy, weird place.
Yes. You know, it is. And it's terrifying.
Yeah, sometimes at night, it is terrifying for me. Maybe it is the night terrors or night sweats, that movie that I made, that little animation. Maybe that was the beginning of me going into my imaginative work, you know, finally getting a chance to express myself. Because I went into another medium and I got a chance to do that. But I don't know. Talking to you has made me, and all these questions, it's been a great opportunity to be kind of self-reflective. And it's been thank you so much for allowing me to do that. I hate being this egocentric. I should ask you more about your pictures. You know, you're asking me all these questions, but I would love to know more about some of your paintings. I was looking at yours on your blog and, you know, the ones of the people that you painted in – do you live right in Dublin? Do you live in a different town in
– Yeah, I live in country. I live in rural part of Ireland called County Kerry. It's down in the kind of toe of Ireland.
Well, those paintings you did that stick out for me, and I love all your work, but the ones that I really love that struck me the most, I think, because I identified with the imaginative side of it, was the paintings of the people in the village – that have the butterfly wings sprouting out, and they're in different lines of work. Some, there was a person on a tractor, or a person maybe walking down a path. And I thought those are so interesting that they seem to me that they would be like in a movie, and all of a sudden the wings would just kind of materialize on them. And I felt that I really love those. I think those are interesting that you came up with that idea.
Oh, thanks very much.
No, you're welcome.
Yeah, that came in a dream. Speaking of dreams.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Now I remember reading about that, because you had said that they had come to you in a dream. And I've rarely had a dream that had a painting come out of it. But I think that's so interesting that you did have a dream and you painted it.
Yeah. And in the dream, everyone had the big wings and everyone was walking around. And at the start of the dream, I was like nudging my wife going, "Hey, did you see everyone's got like wings? Isn't that really weird?" And by the end of the dream, I just thought it was the most natural thing. It was so natural that when I woke up, I thought, well, I better paint that.
It's great. And you painted quite a few pictures from that too. I mean, it was a whole series.
Six of them.
That's amazing. That's like Robert Louis Stevenson having that dream about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and his wife woke him up. He says, "Why did you wake me up? I was dreaming." And he wrote that whole book or novel from that dream.
Yeah.
I hope one day I'll have a dream that I could paint something from. I've never experienced that.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Yeah. That's all ahead of you, isn't it?
I hope so.
Okay. So your website is just your name, isn't it? DaveLebeau.com. And then all your I think all your social media links off that. You're on Instagram. If it's not, I'll put a link to it. Your blog on your website is very good. I encourage everyone to go and have a look at that. Great process shots. It really, really breaks down your process and how you go about it.
Oh, thank you.
So it's been really nice chatting with you. I was looking forward to chatting with you because, as I said, you know, as I do with everybody, there's you come across, you're such a friendly kind of gregarious kind of person, and your art is really interesting. Like, I've wanted to talk to you for a good while, but I have a longish list of people that I want to talk to, so I've just finally got to you. But I was really glad that I was able to get to you, because I really like that kind of retro pulp kind of thing. Like, I have a little collection of old book covers in that kind of retro style, so I really like that. And then I like your combination of kind of a very classical approach to it, and then just the imagination in your work and the stories and how evocative and imaginative they are. I particularly like that your painting, I think it's called Bad Girl. I was only looking at it last night and I was thinking that's such a perfect little picture because it's got your eye. I could luckily I was conscious enough of my eye going around the picture, picking up little, you know, bits and going, oh, what's that doing there? And oh, what's this over here? Is this really good? It's a great, great painting.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
But then there's just one of many. There's so much of your work is great.
Thank you so much for all those compliments. It makes me feel really good.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure. And it's.
I mean, I just want to say, I mean, when you asked me to be on the podcast, I was like, oh my God, I can't really believe you asked me because I've been listening to it. I'm a fan. I support it even.
You do on Patreon. Thank you very much.
I just didn't think I was as good as all the artists. I don't know. I kind of actually got freaked out when you asked me and I was like, well, what? You know, because a lot of the artists, like the said Dario, you know, I mean, he's so like he's a hero of mine. He's so amazing. And I was like, I can't believe that I'm going to talk on the same podcast. So I couldn't get my head around it at first. And there was a part of me that was really excited and there was a part of me that was kind of freaked out about it. So I'm just glad that I got through it. I thought I'm going to really screw up on this podcast. I don't know why I had that feeling about it, but it's really neat to be able to be asked to be on it. And you do such a great job. It's such an interesting – you have so many interesting artists. You ask great questions, and you are a fun person to talk to, and you've got a great voice, and you're a warm person. I felt like I already knew you just from listening to you through the other podcasts I'd listened to.
Oh,
so
thanks,
it's been a really fun experience to be on it. It really has been.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. And I'm sure we'll keep in touch and I'm sure we'll talk again. But for now, we'll say goodbye.
Bye, John. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, John.
Remember to go to the Gently Does It Patreon page. Go to patreon.com/JohnDaltonGentlyDoesIt and join the conversation.
I've never felt this good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti.
Yeah,
we are the Argyle Pimps, so buy some drinks. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps, so buy some drinks. Come on.